Moss Cohen, welcome back to Radio Times. Yesterday, President Obama signed two executive actions focused on the pay practices of federal contractors with the hopes of reducing what he says is the pay disparity between men and women.
A woman's got to work about three more months in order to get what a man got because she's paid less. That's not fair. That's like adding an extra 6 miles to a marathon.
Obama's one order creates more transparency about information regarding compensation, while the other declared that federal contractors could not punish their employees if they discuss what they were getting paid. The Senate is taking up the issue of pay equity with legislation that would make it easier for a woman to sue if she can prove she's being paid less because of her sex. Well, today in Radio Times, two perspectives on the wage gap. Lisa Matz is Vice President of Government Relations at the American Association of University Women, where she works to advance opportunities for women and girls, including the National Coalition for Women and Girls in Education and the Paycheck Fairness Act Coalition. Lisa Matz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is Mark Perry. He's a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, also professor of economics at the University of Michigan's Flint campus. And Mark Perry, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, Marty.
Let me begin with you, Lisa, if I could. Let's take a man and a woman. They have the same job, the same years of education, the same number of years on the job. They've gotten essentially the same review, all glowing review for their performance on the job. How much of a pay disparity are we talking about here?
Well, AUW's own research, Marty, shows that when you take someone right out of college, which is arguably a time when they're going to be pretty equivalent, they will have the same major, same occupation. You compare those apples to apples. You control for things that reasonable people like you and I would think, yes, should affect their wages, like hours worked and so on and so forth, childbearing. But even 1 year out of college, there's already a 7% gap between men and women, same major or same occupation. That is something that I think really needs to be fixed. Now, I know sometimes our detractors would try to say that 7% isn't very much, but I would defy any of them to be willing to give up 7% of their wages today.
Well, let me give you a chance, Mark Perry, to weigh in on that. Is that fair?
Well, sure, although if you look at other studies, and one was recently, well, a few years ago, was reported in Time magazine, where they looked at single men, single women in America's largest cities, and looked at single men who workers who had never been married and who had no children and were less than 30 years old, that among that cohort group, they found that women actually made 8% more than men. So there are some studies out there that are showing a pay gap in favor of women, and that men are actually earning less because women do so much better in higher education today and get a majority of all the degrees from associate's degrees up to doctoral degrees. So again, depends on the study, but other studies find a small, maybe, you know, between 4-5% or 5-8% differential once you've adjusted for everything. But of course, you can't account for everything. So some of that could be discrimination, could be that, but the gap could also be because of other variables that just haven't been explained very well or accounted for.
And I do want to get to some of those variables, and I don't want to do necessarily dueling studies, but I understand studies can come up with different conclusions. Lisa, can you respond
to
what
Mark
said? Well,
what's interesting about the study he just cited is the fact that it it compares college-educated women with all men. So it's single women in urban areas who have a college education versus men of the same age, whether they have a college education or not. So it would be a sad thing if, in fact, they weren't making more mm-hmm. than someone who had not had a college education.
Do you think there is a pay gap, Mark Perry?
Well, sure, but a lot of it can be explained by factors that are completely understandable, and often the pay gap would be between married men with children and married women with children because of the fact that men and women are not interchangeable in the labor market, and they're not interchangeable in family roles, that men and women play different roles in the labor market, and they play different family roles. And so a lot of that is personal choice, career choices, family choices that don't necessarily mean that corporations are you know, discriminating against women. A lot of it can be based on personal choices.
Personal choices, the choice of having a baby and then staying home for a certain period of time to take care of that baby?
Well, sure. I mean, women generally often prefer, because of their role in the family, more flexible hours They generally prefer office environments to very, very risky jobs. So that's another factor that should be taken into account. We know that men work in more risky occupations that generally pay more, because 92% of all occupational deaths in every year are men working in very risky occupations like mining and logging and farming and construction. And so I've made the point that yesterday was equal pay day to reflect how far into this year women would have to work to earn the same on average as men last year. I created the Equal Occupational Fatality Day and showed that women would be able to enjoy another decade of work before they would experience the same number of deaths on the job as men did last year. So higher risk occupations, predominantly filled by men, get paid higher, and so that's another factor that could explain some of the wage gap.
Well, let me pick up on the first thing that Mark Perry said, and this is to you, Lisa Matz, the idea that a woman's career trajectory is a little different from a man's, in that she might take time off to take care of a child, for instance. How do we factor that
in? You know, we get that all the time, and what I find amusing about that is that there's always this assumption that those choices are not constrained by other factors, like the fact that employers expect women to be the caregivers. And so women who don't have children are still actually penalized for that, because they're assumed to have children someday or to potentially be taking care of parents or so forth. So, yes, I mean, we have this sense that there are these particular family roles for men and women, but because we stick to those stereotypes, women who don't make those choices are still being penalized for that. The other thing that I find interesting about all of that, of course, is that the whole occupational hazard piece, I do think that's true. Obviously, if people are working in jobs that are more hazardous, there's going to be better pay involved. But oftentimes, women are prevented from getting those jobs. There have been countless lawsuits through the years of women who were told they weren't allowed to work in those jobs, even though they wanted to take the risk because they wanted to earn the money for their families. So, you know, the reality is women are the ones who have kids. That's absolutely true. But women are not the only ones who take care of kids, and I know lots of men who would agree with that. So we are actually pigeonholing folks. And when it comes to staying home, if a family actually has that economic luxury, you're always going to pick the person who makes less money. So again, it's not a completely free choice.
Well, let me give you a chance to respond to that, Mark Perry. And I mean, I think it would be a mistake to pit, you know, men versus women, because if there were more work family friendly policies, we might be having a slightly different conversation here.
Well, yeah, and I think as a thought experiment, as strange as this might seem, I think it's useful to think of the fact that if men biologically could get pregnant and could breastfeed, that I think their role in the labor market would be much different than it currently is. So a lot of this has to do with differences in biology and the different roles that men and women play in both the labor market and in family roles. So the other thing is that we often just compare wages, but if we look at compensation, the St. Louis Federal Reserve recently has pointed out that women often prefer jobs with better employee benefits and maybe lower monetary wages, because they may prefer employee paid parental leave, sick leave, and child care to jobs with a higher wage without such benefits. So that's another way that we distort it, by just looking at wages and not total compensation.
Lisa, should we throw in the benefits package?
Well, I think the benefits are important, but again, I think those kinds of choices are constrained too. I mean, you look at the studies, and they all show that when a woman has a child, her wages go down, and when a man has a child, his wages go up. There's very clearly a value judgment there about whose work is more valuable and where that work should be done. The fact of the matter is biology is not destiny, and at the end of the day, there are lots of men who would like to stay home, and by the way, would also like to see their women making good pay as well. I mean, it's a family issue, and I know many men whose wives bring home unfair paychecks who see the real consequence of that in terms of their own lives, in terms of what they go without, in terms of what they can pay for their kids' college and save for their own retirement.
And Mark Perry, remember a couple of years ago doing a show on something people were calling the man session, which was when the recession hit. Oftentimes it was men who were hit hardest because of the kinds of jobs that were either disappearing or because of layoffs. And they were more reliant on the women in their lives to bring home the bacon.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I reported on that for many years, or starting in 2008, about the man session, that men were disproportionately and negatively affected because of the Great Recession, because of the job losses were generally concentrated in manufacturing and housing construction, and those are predominantly male industries. And so, yeah, there was a huge disparity. And so women actually did much better during the recession in terms of having a lower unemployment rate and fewer job losses because they are in, more stable industries like education and healthcare. So that, again, is another difference in the role that men and women play in the labor market.
But would you agree, Mark Perry, that if it's an equal job and people are equally performing well, that they should get paid the same?
Well, sure, and that's the law of the land, and that's supposed to happen, and there's legislation in place to protect that. So, and I guess it's not so much an argument about whether the wage gap after everything's been, accounted for is 3% or 5% or 10%. I think the most important thing or one issue to focus on is we know that it's not 23%, that women are not working in the same jobs as men and getting 23% less, and that's where I think the president and other groups have really, I think, done a disservice to the discussion. And in fact, on today's Washington Post, Glenn Kessler, the fact checker, upgraded Obama's Pinocchios from 1 to 2, and he almost gave him 3 Pinocchios for perpetuating the myth that women are paid 23% less than men on average for doing the same job.
Lisa, let me give a chance to weigh in on that. Is the president wrong?
Well, women are paid, all women are paid 23% or 77 cents on the dollar compared to white men in the labor force. And they're compared to white men because that's the largest sector of the labor force. If the president says 23% or 77 cents for the same job, that's incorrect. But that 77 cents, that is absolutely correct in terms of giving us a red flag and giving us a place to start the conversation about, well, why is there such a wage disparity between men and women? And then you do the thing that I was talking about earlier in terms of regression analysis and crunching for choices and crunching for those things. And it makes, then you start to see what it really looks like. And the fact is that we still have people who aren't being paid equally for the same job. We just had someone testify up on Capitol Hill who found out because her company went into bankruptcy and she had to claim for back vacation days and back pay. As an engineer, she was making less than the 8 men she supervised. And her boss told her it was because they had families. Mm. Now, of course, they didn't come running into her office when she got married and suddenly increase her wages. But that was what she was told. And it's amazing how those old standards, old stereotypes, despite the fact that 4 in 10 families actually depend completely on a woman's salary to see them through, are still what people use to make decisions.
Well, let's take
no matter what the law says. The law does say equal pay for equal work, but we're clearly not there.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. I also want to open up the lines as well. That's Lisa Matz, Vice President of Government Relations at the American Association of University Women, who joins us along with Mark Perry. He's a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, also professor of economics at the University of Michigan's Flint campus. And yesterday was National Equal Pay Day. President Obama talking about it and making a couple of pronouncements at the White House, and has sparked a conversation about equal pay for equal work. Give us a call. What do you think? 1-888-477-9499. How do we evaluate that formula? You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Delaware Valley College. Delaware Valley College offers a Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology that prepares culturally competent practitioners to work in the mental health field. Students can choose from social justice community counseling or child and adolescent counseling. More information about a Master's of Arts in Counseling Psychology from Delaware Valley College is available online at delval.edu/grad.
I'm Megan Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, ukulele virtuoso Jake Shimabukuro grew up loving his instrument.
My parents would have to take the ukulele away from me so that I would do things like my homework and eat dinner or take a shower.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The John James Audubon Center at Mill Grove supports WHYY. From April 12th through the 27th, the museum and the center's annual juried art show will be open to the public. In addition to original works inspired by nature, this year's show features a flock of hundreds of origami passenger pigeons commemorating the centennial of the species extinction. Visitors can hike more than 5 miles of historic trails in the footsteps of America's best-known bird artist. For more information, online, johnjames.audubon.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Mark Perry and Lisa Matz about the pay gap, something the president talked about yesterday. He said that women get paid less than men for the same job, and that is wrong. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Lisa, let me go back to you, and this is something that McClatchy wrote about, I guess it was yesterday or maybe even today, looking at the White House staff, finding that women overall at the White House make 91 cents for every dollar the men make. Does the White House, is it on what, thin ice in making this pronouncement yesterday?
No, but I think the White House suffers from the same problem that a lot of American businesses do. We know, for instance, that there are very few women on the boards of Fortune 500 companies, very few women CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. Of course, we've never had a woman president here. And one of the things that is happening there is that when they compare their workers for the same job, they're making comparable salaries. But what's happening is they have more men in higher positions. It's as simple as that. So do they have an equal pay problem? I don't think so. But do they have an issue in terms of getting more women into higher ranking positions? Sure. And they're not alone in that.
Mark Perry, I mean, we've been talking a bit about sort of women's jobs and men's jobs. So it seems to me, except for maybe some exceptions, so many jobs can be filled by men or women. I'm thinking of finance and banking and teaching and nursing and doctoring and all the kind of service jobs that are so much a part of the economy. It seems to me, largely speaking, shouldn't there be more equity there?
Well, sure, but I'd just like to maybe comment on the president's pay gap at the White House, because I actually started reporting on that 7 months ago and put a number of posts on the American Enterprise blog, you know, detailing the fact that actually women in the White House are make 12% less than men on average. So here we have the president requiring federal contractors to provide information. And now what if they have a 12% pay gap just like the White House? So I think the president has lost a lot of credibility on this issue this week because of the fact that it's been exposed that the White House has its own pay gap. And so while they're lecturing corporations about their pay gap, they have their own. And so I think this is really going to come up time and time again whenever
Except
the president...
the issue. When the pay gap he's talking about, he said 12%, that he said on average. This is the very thing at the top of the hour he was criticizing the president for using the 23% stat for, that it wasn't an apples-to-apples comparison. So, quite frankly, he's already way better than the national average when you talk about that all-women versus white men stat. And then when you start looking at the comparable stuff, they're doing well. The problem, as I said earlier, and it's something that AEW has talked to them about and other women's groups as well, is that we always want to see more women in leadership positions. Leadership positions pay more.
But when you look at 40-hour workers, women make 88% of men on average, according to BLS studies, and the pay gap in the Washington, D.C. area is only 5%. So the fact that the White House has a 12% pay gap, I think, should be disturbing to organizations like AAUW because of the fact that
it's disturbing to me in terms of the leadership issue. It's not disturbing in terms of a pay gap. I mean, we have had conversations and looked at the apples-to-apples comparisons. They're paying people fairly for folks who are doing comparable jobs, but they don't have as many women in leadership positions. It's as simple as that. And so when you do that stat that we've all critiqued before in terms of the all women versus white men, they're going to come out behind just like the rest of the country does. But they're a little less further behind than the rest of the country, and I think that's good. But I also always want to encourage the White House and his administration to have more women in leadership positions. We know from all kinds of studies that companies that have women in higher management and on their boards actually make more money. They do better. So it's not just the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. It's good for business.
I wonder to you, Mark Perry, and this gets a little more personal here, but do you think that when it comes to negotiating for higher salaries, do you think men do a better job than women?
Well, I think that's been documented and written about pretty extensively, and I think there is at least anecdotal or survey evidence that would indicate that men are more aggressive in negotiating starting salaries, they're more aggressive in negotiating annual increases or bonuses or profit sharing. And so I guess maybe that's something that I think is getting some attention, that women maybe should be encouraged or trained to be better negotiators and be more aggressive in their negotiating for starting salaries and bonuses and raises, and that might help address some of the pay gap.
Do you agree with that, Lisa?
Well, I would agree, but with one cautionary note, and that is that you assume we always want to encourage women to negotiate when it seems appropriate and comfortable to do so. But we also have to remember that, you know, we have special names in our culture for women who are considered to be too aggressive, right? So there's a different risk for women who assert themselves and try to negotiate than there are for men. And that's been documented as well. So AUW believes that we should teach women to negotiate, but they need to have a lot more information to have that confidence and to really approach it in a way that's going to be constructive, but also to know when to back off, because quite frankly, they've got cultural stereotypes going against them and oftentimes can actually be penalized if they're seen as being too aggressive.
That's the B word you're talking about, Lisa?
That would be the B word, yes.
Do you think that's a problem, Mark, that a woman aggressively negotiating for a salary is seen as a bitch?
Well, I think in the past that might have been the case. I think things have changed. I think the millennial generation is much different. And so I guess it's interesting, though, that Sheryl Sandberg and the Girl Scouts want to ban the word bossy. But then on the other hand, maybe they shouldn't ban the bossy attitude when it comes to negotiating. And I think HR departments now are sensitive to the fact that men and women are both have maybe different negotiating styles. And so I think that, I think that things have changed a lot over the decades.
Lisa, anything you want to add to that? Then I do want to get to our callers.
Yeah, I don't think that things have changed as much as you'd like to think. I think people know what they're supposed to say. I think they're supposed to say, yes, men and women should negotiate and there shouldn't be a difference. I think that HR departments know what they're supposed to say in terms of how they perceive that. But at the end of the day, the folks who are making these decisions are human beings like you and me who are affected by the same kind of cultural stereotypes and nonsense that, while it is lesser than it has been, is still in some respects quite just as overt and sometimes also very, very covert. So, things have gotten better, but at the same time, there are many things that have not changed.
And that's Lisa Matz from the American Association of University Women, Mark Perry, scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Let me get to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Jessica from Doylestown to join our conversation. Hi, Jessica. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment, something your guest had said, that when women and men decide who should stay at home with the kids, that it will always be the person who makes less money. And I really disagree with this, and I personally chose to stay at home with my children. I left my full-time job, and I was making more money than my husband. And I just to be really careful about saying a blanket statement like that and assuming that that's how a decision is made, because I think it only reinforces in people's minds that women are making less money and that it's the normal way for business to go, when, in fact, you know, I think that some women do choose to stay home and herself.
Okay.
And it would be better.
And Jessica, we don't have a very good phone line, but I know that was Lisa Matz who said that. Jessica's taking that kind of personally.
Well, I regret that. I think that it's clear that a lot of times when families are weighing these decisions that who makes more money is going to weigh heavily. Obviously, she's clearly an example that it doesn't happen every single time. But I do think for a lot of families that does constrain their decision. It's not necessarily as free as they'd like it to be.
Let me get, looks like Chris from Voorhees, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. And Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank
there.
You. Great discussion.
Thank
and
you.
Very civil by today's Washington standards, so that's great.
we try.
Putting aside or acknowledging there's some disagreement about that 77-cent number and all those things, and under the premise that we agree that there's some level of discrimination, that there's some level of educational differences and so forth, being that we would, I hope, agree on some level of that, are there one or two things just for fun that you two on different sides, so to speak, could agree on? What are two initiatives that could be taken, and let's say not governmentally, because that's a whole other
sure.
debate, but in society, what are two things you could agree on that should be done to better any inequality that does exist without trying to nail down what the amount is.
And Chris, I'm going to put you on the spot here because it's an interesting question. It's kind of a broad-based question. Is there one thing that you would like to ask them if they agree on? I have one, but I was curious whether you have one.
Sure. Well, I think, and I am actually in my background a work family researcher, but I'm also in management now. So I see both sides of it. But let's say work hour flexibility, right? Often talked about, sure. Available to some percentage, depending on how you define flexibility. My thought is acknowledging it's not possible in some cases, that it's abused in some cases. To me, it's also not offered in cases due to a lack of creativity, a paranoia.
Right.
What are the, with technology or whatnot, I would say more flexible work hours.
Okay, let's see if we can get some agreement on that. Chris, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Mark Perry, is that something you could apply, broadly speaking, across the board to all employees?
Well, sure, and I think that technology is changing. I mean, you look at the amount of telecommuting that goes on during the snowstorms in Washington, D.C. is one example. So I think that's more commonly accepted now, the telecommuting. And so I guess if that introduces a new level of flexibility, mm-hmm. that would allow either men or women to stay home more often and be with their kids, that I think that could be that could change the way the labor market works, and it could be more flexible for both men and women. And I don't know that we need legislation to make that happen, but I think companies are moving in that direction just naturally.
What do you think, Lisa?
I do think that there is some movement in terms of companies doing that, and I do agree that having more flexibility would be good. I don't think that it's moving quickly enough, especially with the number of women with kids and men with kids in the workplace. So I would love to see some government ways to incentivize that. But I think it's a great idea. But I would like, because hopefully it would take us away from always assuming that FaceTime is what counts rather than, productivity and quality and so forth, because a lot of times in the workplace, when you have companies that promote based on that, it's going to disadvantage the women. The other thing I would say, though, is that I would love to see financial literacy training starting much younger. I would love to see kids getting financial literacy training. We've seen fascinating studies that talk about that there's a gender gap when it comes to allowances for kids, and some of that has to do with,
really?
Again, what jobs are seen as appropriate for girls versus what jobs are seen as appropriate for boys. The girls get the dishes, the boys get the lawn mowing, and lawn mowing pays more. I can understand that. It's probably harder work. But there's still absolute decisions being made even at that level. And financial literacy starting for kids, not only when it comes to equal pay, but knowing their worth, understanding about savings, I think would be good for everybody.
Let me get Lois from Newark, Delaware to join us. Hi, Lois. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes, I have 35 years with a major chemical company, and I would like to make a suggestion or find out what other people think. I'm sure it's not the first time they've heard this, but publicizing salaries in a major corporation with 87,000 people would make a huge difference in opening that black hole that you're working and you're on level three and you have 65 other people that are your comparable, positions, but you have no idea what they make or why they make it or where you are on that huge management bell curve that they talk about. Well, everyone's at the top of the bell curve. Well, maybe you're not. Maybe you're at the bottom and you don't know because you have no idea what this poor performer next to you, because he's good friends with management. And it's so subjective that I would need to lean forward or be called a pushy broad if I knew what other people were making. And I could say, look, in black and white, can you explain to me why this man is a poor performer and he's making more than me?
Well, Lois,
I think that would open up the discussion for everyone and it just be calm and not emotional.
In fact, it's an issue we're going to take up with our third guest, but in fact, it was the question I was going to put to our current guests. To you, Mark Perry, if there's more transparency about salaries, would that help to sort of equalize some of the things we've been talking about?
Well, sure, and it'd make the economic analysis and regression analysis a lot easier to get actual, micro-level data. But I would just say, I'm an employee of the University of Michigan, and my salary is public, and it's on a website. So, I mean, there are at least public organizations that publish or are required to publish or voluntarily publish all of their salaries. And so I think that transparency is good and allows us to uncover any possible, discrimination that might exist.
In fact, Lily Ledbetter, Lisa Metz, didn't learn about her, the salary discrepancy for her until, you know, years, until someone actually told her.
Yeah, 19 years. She found out via anonymous note in her mailbox at work because Goodyear, even though they were a government contractor at the time and still are, had policies that you could not talk about your salary at work, and she was told in her interview that if she did, she'd be fired. So she did other things. She asked her boss how she could perform, you know, how she could increase her raises and what she would need to do to get, you know, even better reviews. But she couldn't ask those questions. And so she got this anonymous note. And, you know, we still don't know who gave her that note because actually up until the president signing this executive order, that person could still be fired for having told her. But it's one of the reasons, quite frankly, when we talk about transparency, why you see unions having much greater gender equality in terms of pay and higher paid jobs as well, because it's out there in the open for everybody to see. And that doesn't mean that we don't understand business and competition and the fact that there are some really competitive employees that we need to be proprietary about, but having a way to be more transparent so that we can actually do that apples to apples comparison really would make a big difference. It's not what we have with the executive order yesterday. That's just being able to talk about it. It's not actually sharing everybody's salary.
Well, let me squeeze one more caller in. This is Mike from Bethlehem. Mike, I want to just give you 30 seconds to make your point, and that'll give our guests a chance to respond. Go ahead.
Oh, good morning. Yeah, my wife was a professor at Lehigh University. She taught there for 10 years. And then they hired a male in the same department, and he was being paid twice what she had was being paid after being there 10 years. Plus, she had about 50, 60 students. He had 7 or 8 with adjunct help, and she didn't have any. And so here's a university that doesn't have to, I guess, provide their pay for their professors, but it should be open to everybody, and that's what has happened at this particular private university.
Well, Mike, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Mark Perry, I'd be curious about your response.
Well, yeah, like I say, at the University of Michigan, all of our salaries are publicly available, and so I guess that would never happen at a institution like the University of Michigan. I mean, partly just because they wouldn't allow it, but also because there's, you know, their salaries are public, so they could never get away with it, even if they wanted to. So my experience in hiring men and women in higher education is that at least for professor positions, that there's no difference at all in pay between men and women.
Anything you want to add to that? Because you're at the American Association of University Women, Lisa?
Yeah, no, there's lots of difference between pay for men and women. There's lots of, in terms of professorships, there's lots of difference whether they're the same rank. Obviously, women are actually much more concentrated in the adjunct and the assistant professor levels. But even amongst public universities that have this information go public, they still have discrepancies, and they come up with all kinds of reasons as to why they do what they do. So the transparency is great, and it gives people advocacy tools so that they can fight for themselves, and also hopefully for the company in question to do its own proactive evaluation. Because trust me, we don't want the lawsuits; we just want the fair pay. But I think
at the end of the day,
we need to recall that we still got that gap.
Well, it's the end of our portion of this interview, Lisa Metz. Thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times, and Mark Perry, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
My pleasure. Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome. And stay with us. We'll be right back.
Westtown School supports WHYY. Westtown invites families to their 650-acre campus for 3 spring events, an activity-filled celebration of science and the opening of their new LEEDS Certified Science Center on Science Day, April 12th, a pre-K through 12 open house April 21st, and the Splash and Dash 5K Run and Youth Triathlon April 27th. Details for all 3 events at westtown.edu/april@westtown. Westtown School. Expect a life-size education.
The pressure to be popular makes a pressure cooker out of high school.
What's much more common is conflict among kids who are high status. They're kind of jockeying for a position, and they're going after each other.
What you learn in high school is more complex than simply don't be a bully. Stories from the high school food chain next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. the Philadelphia Orchestra, under Gian Andrea Nuzzada, performed Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony with the power of the Fred J. Cooper Memorial Organ's 6,938 pipes. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or at philorg.org. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Kimmel Center, Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Yesterday was National Equal Pay Day, and President Obama used the occasion to sign executive orders that would give some workers greater access to pay scales to see if they are being shortchanged. Would it be good for the workplace if everyone knew everyone else's salary? It's an issue that came up in the first portion of this hour of Radio Times, and something we are going to talk about with our guest, Stephanie Thomas. She's a lecturer in the Department of Economics at Cornell University, also a research associate at Cornell's Institute for Compensation Studies. And Stephanie Thomas, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Let's see if we can get her squared away. Let's see if we can get Stephanie Thomas squared away. And in the meantime, I will give out that phone number, and it's 1-888-477-9499. Stephanie Thomas, do we have you?
I'm here.
Very good. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Can people talk about their salaries at work? Is that legal to do these days?
Well, it is legal to do, and I think that there's a lot of confusion about what employees are and are not allowed to talk about. There's the National Labor Relations Act, which is a relatively older law, and that allows employees, irrespective of their union status, to talk about the terms and conditions of employment. And compensation is certainly part of the terms and conditions of employment. So under the National Labor Relations Act, it is legally permissible to discuss compensation. Interestingly, a lot of people think that they're not allowed to talk about conversations or to have conversations about pay. There was a study done a couple of years ago by the Institute for Women's Policy Research and the Rockefeller Foundation. And among private sector companies, 61% of employees said that they were either discouraged or prohibited from having conversations about their pay, which, you know, they're allowed to under the National Labor Relations Act, and certainly with President Obama's executive order yesterday, now there's a penalty for employer retaliation as a result of those conversations.
And when you're talking about conversation, is it someone saying to someone else, what do you make? Or someone saying, I make X number of dollars. I'm curious, how much do you make? Are these the kinds of conversations we're talking about?
Yeah, and it really can be, you know, you initiating the conversation. This is what I make. What do you make? Or somebody coming up to you with the water cooler and saying, you know, I've been thinking about pay equity and I'm not really sure where I fall. You know, what do you make? Where am I relative to you? It doesn't necessarily have to be any kind of a formal conversation. They're usually very informal, water cooler type discussions that just take place.
Do you think that's a good thing for people at a workplace to know what other people are making?
Well, I think I make a distinction between pay transparency and pay secrecy. And I think there's a difference between having open and transparent compensation policies and practices and posting a roster of everybody's salary on the break room bulletin board. I think disclosing individual details has the potential to be dangerous, and it can create a lot of problems in the workplace. But I think the preferable approach is to take a pay transparency approach where employees understand how their salaries are determined and what they need to do to get from point A to point B on the salary scale.
And do you think companies do a good enough job in explaining that process to their employees?
I think that some employers do, but I think that some employers don't. And part of the problem, I think, is there's a greater use of variable pay or pay for performance structures now. And because we're using pay for performance more, it introduces an additional complexity in communicating those pay systems to employees. And it's, you know, it's a real challenge. We're actually doing a program on that right now to educate employers about how to have a transparent pay policy with respect to variable pay. You need to make sure that the employees understand what's expected of them, what rewards they're going to receive if they meet those specific goals, and, you know, what the potential punishments are for not meeting those goals.
I was reading about a company in New York where pay, you know, the salary information is posted online and everyone has access to it. The argument being that, you know, this is our company. We believe in what we pay people. We will stand behind it. We will defend it. We will explain it. And the idea was that it creates a more open workplace, a more democratic workplace. I think the disparity between the highest and lowest paid is not gigantic. But is there an argument for that, do you think?
There is an argument, and there has been some research done, that we don't really have a direct link between what I call pay openness and, you know, disclosing who makes what. There's no direct link between pay openness and pay equity, but there is some evidence that there's a relationship between the two, right? We can't make the direct link, but companies that are more forthcoming about their compensation policies and practices tend to have smaller gaps with respect to gender, race, ethnicity, protected group statuses of different kinds, and really even just general equity overall without respect to protected group.
Which, that's interesting, which is, I guess, either companies that do this probably have good policies that allow for the kind of diverse workplace that you're describing.
Well, and I think that's really the starting point. It's important to have a strong foundation for your compensation program. And it's critical to understand what you want to reward people for. So, you know, when employers make compensation decisions, they're not just dartboarding these numbers. There's a logic and a process that goes into making those decisions, whether it's considering performance evaluations, whether it's considering educational attainment and who's completed recertification credits or gotten a particular license or certification. Those things all factor into the pay decision. And I think the danger of having, you know, I make this, what do you make, is those legitimate factors that go into the pay decision are not always in the front of the minds of the employees having the conversation.
I do want to get to our callers, but I'm also thinking about the tough times that so many companies have been through in the last couple of years where people either haven't gotten raises or people have been laid off. Has that kind of complicated the compensation structure because so many companies were just trying to hold their head above water?
I think so. I think the budget crunch has made it difficult. And, you know, the company is always faced with the dilemma of having a desire to pay their employees more to retain them and, you know, wanting to do right by their employees, but at the same time, they may not have the ability to pay and give the raises that they really want to give. So it sort of puts employers in a tough spot. But again, you need to be open and honest with your employees and communicate the logic behind your decisions.
And that's Stephanie Thomas. She's a lecturer in the Department of Economics at Cornell University and a research associate at Cornell's Institute for Compensation Studies. And talking in this portion of Radio Times about more transparency, more openness about salaries at the workplace, some of the pros and some of the cons. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Sandy from, looks like, Lambertville, New Jersey, to join us. Sandy, go ahead. You're on the air.
I'd like to second just about everything that Professor Thomas has to say and point out that there's an enormous system called civil service that works with great transparency.
Okay.
I would just like to point out that it's this huge universe of people, and they all know what each other is paid because all you need is to know their job title and time and service, and you can compute their salary, you know, on the back of an envelope.
Well,
and nobody cares.
Well, that's interesting, Sandy. Let me pick up on that, and let me toss that to you, Stephanie Thomas. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, there is the argument that, you know, why do we really care about what someone else is making relative to our salary? And if I know what you're making and I know what I'm making, does it really make a difference to me in the workplace? And, I mean, for some people, sure, it is going to make a difference. But I think that there's also a group of employees who they don't really care. It's not on the front of their minds. And, you know, if we were to disclose compensation information about their coworkers, it's not really going to have an impact on their behavior. It's not really going to have an effect on their work performance. It's not really going to have an effect on, you know, their level of commitment or engagement to the organization. So in some senses, it really is kind of a who cares issue.
But I think people care if they see someone who is a slacker or underperforming or coming in late or leaving early. Things like that, where you just, I can imagine employees being very frustrated to think, this person is getting paid what I'm getting paid, and look at how they perform.
Absolutely. And we've all encountered those kinds of situations in our work history. I'm sure you have.
Sure.
I've encountered that. It's just a part of the workplace that we function in. And, you know, if we have those kinds of cases, then certainly pay equity is going to be a higher priority, and we're going to be more concerned about it. But again, I'm not sure that fully disclosing John makes this and Jane makes this is really going to improve the situation, you know, and improve how you feel. It's probably going to cause you more frustration. And, you know, what's the ultimate outcome going to be?
But frustration because as an employee you feel like you can't do anything about it?
I think that's part of it. But again, you know, and unfortunately there are cases of pay discrimination with respect to gender, race, ethnicity, you know, the old boys network, those kinds of things unfortunately still do occur. But I think we have to balance that with the idea that compensation decisions are based on a lot of things that aren't necessarily immediately obvious about the person.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not easy to quantify the difference between a good performer and an excellent performer. And we have to think about those when we're looking at pay equity, and they don't always come to the forefront in those employee conversations.
Let me see what Julie has to say. Julie calling us from Glenside. Go ahead, Julie. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. I just wanted to comment. I'm a public teacher, so I am part of a union, and I think having the equity between genders is incredible in the public system. If I did not have this contract, there's no way I'd be making as much money as the male teachers in our buildings, because many of our, especially in our secondary schools, we have male principals. And I think there definitely would be an old boys. You see it even in terms of who gets to turn in their papers late or who gets a little, you know, that gets to leave a little early. It definitely would have transferred over into salary if we didn't have the union. Also, I think it frees me up that I don't have to be worried ever about thinking, do I have to go in and try and do this negotiation? I can really concentrate and put my focus on to what I'm supposed to be doing, which is teaching and helping the children, and that I don't have to take this worry of salary along with me on a daily basis.
Well, that's interesting.
I just wanted to comment that I think the union definitely does a good thing, and I know teachers get a bad shift every once in a while for the union, and when parents say something to me, especially parents of daughters, I say, this union is protecting me as a woman, and it's making sure that I'm going to make the same next to me. And quite honestly, I heard you say that, well, what about, you know, the people that aren't doing good and they're not doing as good as me? That's why we have performance reviews. That's why we have systems in place for managers and administrators. And if somebody really isn't doing their job, then that's the job of the administrator or the job of the manager to then get rid of that person.
Julie, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Stephanie, talking about unions sort of not only protecting salaries, but sort of taking care of this issue so that Julie doesn't have to think about it so much.
Yeah, and I think that Julie makes an excellent point that, you know, because she feels comfortable that the pay system that she's, you know, being compensated under is a fair and objective process, she's freed up to think about how to perform better, how to teach her students more creatively, and she really can focus on her work and not have to worry about, am I being paid properly, am I being discriminated against, what's going on? And I think that even in the non-union environment, creating an open system about compensation and, you know, having this pay transparency so people understand, you know, what the ranges are for specific positions and what they need to do to move forward and move up those pay scales, you know, again, even in the non-union environment, that can free people up and sort of take the issue of pay equity off of center stage and free them up to really focus on what's important in the workplace.
Do people understand about pay scales, and do you think, broadly speaking, they make sense? Because I think for a lot of companies, you know, there are people who are doing different jobs and they're categorized as being in the same pay scale, but sometimes it's hard to understand how those decisions are being made.
Yeah, I think, you know, again, like anything, there are some companies that do a really good job at it, and there are some companies that do a not-so-good job at it. But I think that it's important for companies to constantly revisit this issue. You know, once you determine your pay scales for a particular array of jobs, just like you review job descriptions, because the duties and responsibilities evolve over time, you have to continually revisit your compensation structure and make sure that it's still working for the organization the way it exists today, that it's working the way you think it's working. And, you know, it takes some effort to keep these things evergreen and keep everything in alignment.
We're almost out of time here, but do you think there are generational issues? You think sort of younger workers are sort of less private about their salary or their pay?
That's a really interesting point. And I think that there are generational differences. I do think that younger people tend to be more open to having these kinds of compensation conversations. I think that there's a stigma attached with having conversations about pay, and I think that that stigma is less for the younger people than it is for the older people. There's, you know, some of us who've been in the workforce for a while, we still feel uncomfortable talking about pay, but I think that the millennials, if that's what you want to refer to them as,
sure,
they have a greater tolerance for those kinds of conversations, and they're more open, and they, you know, whether it's a function of social media that they grew up with or technology, they're more open about a lot more, and they're more open about pay.
Well, Stephanie Thomas, thank you so much for joining us in this portion of Radio Times.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can continue this conversation on our homepage. Also check out Facebook and Twitter, podcasts, and satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.